Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the whole network galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
You're listening to the Pennsylvania Woodsman, powered by Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network.
This show is driven to provide relatable hunting and outdoor content in the Keystone State and surrounding Northeast.
On this show, you'll hear an array of perspectives from biologists and industry professionals
to average Joes with a lifetime of knowledge.
All centered around values aiming to be better outdoorsmen and women,
both in the field as well as home and daily life.
No clicks, no self-interest. Just the light in the pursuit of creation.
And now, your host, the man who's too good to stop for a roadkill deer to check it out, Mitchell Shirk.
Hey Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Pennsylvania Woodsman Podcast. I hope you're excited as I am. I'm not ready at all. I've still got gear that I'm trying to figure out. I'll just share a quick story with you. I have all these great ideas of all these little projects and tinkerings that I'm going to undertake. And I got to be real. I am not the most handy person in the world. I've got really, really handy people in my life and family. My dad is a skilled carpenter. I've got uncles that can fix just about anything but a broken heart. I mean, I've got a grandfather who I think could configure any type of configuration you wanted, right? He can modify anything to make it work. It's just that's my family. And me, I know just enough to get myself in trouble, but I'm really not good, and it usually takes me three times as long as it would take a normal person to do stuff. So I got the brilliant idea. I was going to do some modifications to my hunting sticks. I got some new sticks this year. I think I shared on another podcast that I got some bee sticks I found on Facebook Marketplace, which I really, really like those sticks because they're solid. They grip into the tree really well. They don't have any folding piece. They're just a solid stick, right? And I used a stick years ago that had a cam cleat on it for an attachment. And the thing I love about a cam cleat is you can get a long rope. You can whip it around the tree with virtually no noise, put it through the cam cleat, do an overhand knot, and you're on your way. It sets real quick, and I just like that style. The other thing I like about the B-Stick is it has those holes drilled through it, right? So one of the things I hate about all sticks is the stacking, and I just can never get a stacking feature that I'm really liking and comfortable with. And I've seen people do this on the B-Stick where they take a bolt, and they'll run a bolt with some shrink wrap over top of it, just leave enough with the threads on the end, run it through the holes of the sticks, and then run a stopper knot on the end and tighten it up, and it's as solid as can be. And I just love the concept. I think it's just the best concept for me personally. So I saw all these YouTube clips, right, and I got the brilliant idea I'm going to do this. So I get all the materials, or so I thought. I come to realize when I did the project, I got the wrong rope. I got quarter-inch size rope, but it was not the working load that I needed, and I didn't look very closely when I bought it. And the screws that I bought, I've needed 10-24 screws an inch and a half long for the cam cleats to go into the sticks. And, you know, I did all my measuring. I drilled out my holes. Fortunately, I didn't botch any of that, and all the holes are drilled to the right place, the right size. But I go to figure out which hex bit that I need for my screw, and I bought one of those stupid screws that it has a hex head, but in the center of it is one of those pins. It's like one of those safety screws like you'd see in a bathroom stall so somebody can't loosen it. That's the screws I bought. I didn't see it when I bought them at the hardware store. So had to go get the right screws. I'm going to Little Mountain Outfitters to go get the rope I need because I just decided I only want to do this project once, and they have AM steel, and I'm going to modify it the way I want. So I've extended the life of this project longer than I wanted, but I'm getting closer at least, and I think there's hope. This past weekend I was back down in Jersey, and I think I'm going to do the exact same thing this year that I did last year. I'm not on anything for Pennsylvania for the opening week. As far as hunting, I don't have a lot of confidence in something. I don't need to shoot a doe right away, so I'm not in a huge hurry there. And I'm planning to do an extended period of hunting that week, so I'm trying to put my focus there. And I've been putting bait and running cameras, and I feel pretty confident there. So I'm probably the next two weekends leading into this bear season, I plan to run down, keep some of those baits fresh. You know, in Jersey, you're allowed to run bait sites. And if you're bear hunting, you cannot sit legally within 300 feet of a bait. But, you know, I've found a couple places that it's still going to be effective for me, right? I have a couple places, one in particular I'm real excited about, where it's a funnel. It's this natural pinch ditch of woods and I put a bait site there. But if you follow it down 100 yards, it wraps around a pond, and it creates this natural little pinch point. And, man, I've had bear that go to that bait site and then pinch down right past that pond, and it just makes me excited to think that it's going to be a really good pinch point stand that will relate to that bait, and hopefully it'll be to my advantage. Obviously, I don't have any problem with bait. It's legal in the state of New Jersey, and, it's legal to shoot a deer over. So who knows? If I'd get a bear, maybe I'd sit over a bait pile and shoot deer. I never did that before. It seems really, really weird and foreign to me. But, hey, when in Rome, do as the Romans, I guess. So that's where I'm at with deer season. Guys, wherever you're at, I really hope you have the best of luck. Stay safe. And just be thankful that we get to do this. It's not a guarantee that we get to do this every year, right? It's a gift. It's a privilege. And I feel like in so many ways in life, the privilege could be revoked from us. And be thankful and appreciate what we do get. And don't let it ruin other aspects of life. The one thing I'll say is when it comes to hunting, there is not an animal on the face of the earth that is worth tainting any personal relationship with a friend or family, anything like that. Whether you're hunting in a group and you are butting heads about how to go about something or where to hunt with somebody, if you can have the mindset of you love your neighbor and you'd rather see them go to a spot and be successful over you. If you have that mindset, number one, I think you're bound to be successful because I don't see how you can't be, because if you have that loving mindset with somebody, how can you not be successful together? And if you don't have that mindset, then I think you really need to consider walking away from hunting with anybody. And it's just reevaluating how you want to handle stuff like that. I that's all I'm going to say about that. How about that? So good luck, be safe, be thankful, and enjoy your hunting season. This week, I am back with Mr. Steve Chilcote, and kind of a unique thought as to how to start the hunting season off in a conversation. And I think this episode goes really well, and it goes really well, not just for private land people who want to have timber cut on their property, but if you're hunting public land and you want to have a better understanding of forestry, the types of cuts that you might see on public land, and how they relate to your hunting and what the purpose of them is. If you're ever standing looking at cut and go, this doesn't make sense, this is a great episode for all of us to relate to. And we're going to dive in and have a discussion about the types of forestry cuts, how they benefit, how they are well applied, how they can be well applied strictly for timber, and how they also relate to wildlife. The goal of this, and Steve is a very wildlife-oriented forester, but he understands forestry and silviculture and how to grow a forest, right? So Steve does a really good job of sharing with us the benefits in both worlds, how they relate, how they contrast. And I got a feeling by the end of it, it should give you some light as to, number one, what are the purposes of some of the cuts that you see out there when you're hunting state forest land or game lands or stuff like that. And, the other thing, too, is if you're hunting and you have your own land or a lease or something and you're thinking about a cut, a lot of the times that there's little nuances within a specialty like forestry that you don't pick up on when you're listening to somebody on YouTube and stuff, make recommendations of how to cut your timber. And I think a lot of us can get just enough information to make ourselves get in trouble. And you're really better off for the long term consulting professionals. I mean, I suggest that obviously in the world of agriculture for certain aspects. That's what I do. Steve is a consulting forester, and he can put a lot of good things, little nuances into your plan that you wouldn't really see if you didn't ask the right questions. And you can avoid a lot of headache and frustration down the road with making timber cuts in your property. So let's dive into this episode. Shout out to our partners, Radix Hunting. Guys, I'm running MCOR cell cameras. They are not bear proof. They are not raccoon proof. I have not found a camera out there that is any of those things. But you know what? They're probably the easiest camera that I've ever set up, and I've had great luck with them using them this season and seasons in prior. They set up on the Scout Tech app. Check out Radix Hunting, Gen 700 trail cameras, and any of the gear that Radix has to offer. Blinds, tree stands, I've been thrilled with it. I use stick and pick camera accessories for trail cameras. Screw it into the trees and logs and stuff that you just don't have that that perfect tree to put your camera on with a strap. Check out Radix Hunting. Huntworth gear. So I've been saying before and I'll say again, Huntworth gear, in my opinion, probably has 90% of the quality you'll find out there in any clothing company in the market, and 50% the cost. And right now, if you go on to huntworthgear.com and you use the code HUNT20SPECIAL, you will get 20% off if your your order is over $200. Free shipping on orders over $200 and 20% off coupon. So it's HNT20SPT. HNT20SPT. Guys, check out any of the gear they have to offer. If I was going to recommend something that would get you through the majority of hunting season, check out the Elkins brand. It's a mid-weight clothing that does really, really well through almost all of archery season. You put a base layer on with it later. You know, it's not going to be real great here when it's 80 degrees, but man, when you drop into the 50s and 60s, it's something I'd put on in the tree. Also, check out the Durham pants and the Sheldon hoodie. That's the best lightweight stuff. Heat Boost, they've got Heat Boost coming in regular wear clothing. Check out Huntworth. And lastly is the Little Mountain Outfitters. So you heard me earlier, I was talking about my little project there, and you heard me say, I bought my sticks from Facebook Marketplace. And me saying something like that is like the thing that would make any store owner cringe, right? Purchasing something online, going to an online website, going to Facebook Marketplace, not supporting local business, right? But you know what? I've openly admitted this. I have a budget. I'm conservative in how I cost it. I go about things the way I want. But you know what? I also know the value that comes from a shop like that, right? So I purchased something that I wanted to modify my own, and that's the awesome thing about Little Mountain Outfitters is they have the abnormal gear at this store to make do with what I want to do, right? They have the rope modifications, the aider modifications, all that stuff that is a little bit not of the norm. You're not going to typically find within your normal brands. You're not going to find in any general hardware store. That's where a store like this comes into play. The same thing can be said with any of their archery gear, right? Go to littlemountainoutfitters.com, check out their website, check out all they have to offer in regards to their archery gear, their saddle gear, their hunting gear. And if you're not somebody, if you don't live close to Richland, Pennsylvania, you can go to littlemountainoutfitters.com, check out all they have to offer. They've got great gear. You can get all that shipped to your door, and if you use the code WOODSMAN10, that's WOODSMAN10, you can get 10% off of your purchase. It's going to support Little Mountain Outfitters, and it's also going to support this podcast, and I appreciate you guys checking out my sponsors, my partners of the show, guys that are really important to me. I value them, and they do great things here, and they have great products and great service, and I really encourage you to support them to continue this show and continue to expand and improve upon your hunting. All right, that's what I got. So let's chat with Mr. Chilcoat.
All right, back with us on the line this week is my friend Steve Chilcoat. It's good to have him back. And Steve, I got to ask you a question. This has nothing to do with what we're going to talk about, but I've noticed this in my day-to-day life, okay? And it's driving me nuts, and everybody faces it, right? I got to ask, how do you handle managing the ongoing advancements of technology in day-to-day life? Because for me, it's getting to be like, I'm starting to feel, I'm pretty young, I'm 31 years old, right? But there's so many times here recently that I am starting to feel old. I'm behind the eight ball. I can't figure stuff out. So I'm curious, like, do you embrace technology or not?
I do. And then I do. I actually have people say, oh, man, I can't believe you're really up on all this stuff. I'm like, I'm not up on anything. And I'll tell you what my solution is. I go over to Penn State and I look around for a student. And they have access to some fancy software that I can't afford. And, you know, they grew up on computers. You know, the computer was not in use until I was like 40 years old, remember? Okay. So I never even used one until I went to grad school. Mm. So you can imagine what it was like for me. Here you go. I want you to write a thesis on this and analyze this data. I'm like, I had no clue. And I made it through, you know, but it was, that was hard. And I never really retained a lot of it either. Like I used GIS a lot and I took a course in it and I actually got a certificate in it from Penn State. And I don't want to use it. It's very expensive and it's very complicated. It's always a problem. And I have a guy that's interning for me right now at Penn State that he's actually supposed to complete a map for me this weekend. I just give it to him. And he has no problem with any of it. He makes beautiful maps. And the problem is he's going to graduate, and then I'm going to be stuck just myself.
I like the way you allocate resources accordingly. Yeah. That's important.
And, you know, it's good to surround yourself with people smarter than you are. That's always been my philosophy.
That's a great philosophy because then you can ask the questions instead of somebody asking you the questions. I love it. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, today you're going to be in the hot seat and you're getting the questions on the podcast. But yeah. I think it's in something we can talk about pretty well. So obviously, as this episode launches, we are in the heart of archery season. We're starting it up, right? This episode is launching. Archery season starts Saturday this week. And you know, from the context of a private landowner, even somebody who hunts public, you know, I'm sure you can take away some stuff what we're going to talk about in the world of timber. But you've told me this before, and I think now's a good time to talk about it. Every year, people go hunt, and if they don't have a good experience, they start going back to the drawing board of why. What can I do to my land? And it usually involves timber harvest, right? And people do timber harvest good ways. They do bad ways. There's a lot of controversy in how to do timber harvest. And I want to walk through some of that with you today. So the first thing that I want to ask you is when you think about cutting timber, this is the example I'll give you, Steve. I had a farmer come to me and ask me questions about the timber harvest on their property. Why me? I have no idea. I'm an agriculture guy, probably because I've got plant nerd biology behind me, and so they asked my opinion. But he said, I had somebody come give me a quote on what my timber value is worth and said, you know what, this isn't worth it. There's not enough here for me to value cutting this. I would wait a little bit longer. And then the next person came and offered him an exorbitant amount above what the first person did and said, there's a lot here. And he said, that sounds good to me. And he cut his timber with that second opinion and ran with it. And man, there were so many things I don't know about the backstory, but just on the surface to me, it made me cringe because I felt like the potential of somebody cutting the best, letting the rest, and not really asking the right questions of what this landowner's objectives were. I just felt like the short term sounded appealing, the long term sounded bad. So I'm around that framework. I want to ask you, what does a forester versus a logger do?
Man, what a loaded question.
It is a loaded question. I'm sorry. I'm fueled today, man. You caught me. Usually I'm doing podcasts in the evening, and my mind's fried. My kids drained me. We're doing a podcast at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday. Yeah. My mind's sharp.
Yeah, me too. I'm ready to go. So here's the thing. I was just talking. I had a logger call me last night. I said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm marking timber. And you know, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, here's another landowner who did not call a forester. He's just called a logger. Now, in that case, he's a pretty good logger, and he's going to treat the guy fairly. And however, when you sell your timber to a logger and you let him take whatever he wants, that's a high grade every time. No logger is going to go on your property and say, well, I shouldn't say no. No, there's no absolutes, but most loggers, while they're there, they want to get as much out of that property as they can possibly get, right? And you can't blame them for that because timber's hard to come by. And when you get on a property, you want to cut it. Mm-hmm. So if you have a forester, I can go in and I can mark the timber according to the way the landowner wants. Now, the reason it's a loaded question is because the landowners, a lot of times, they don't know what they want.
Right.
A lot of times, you know, I get this a lot where a guy will say, I want to make sure that there's timber left for my kids, but I want all the money I can get right now. Well, you know, that's the two different goals there.
Right.
So if a guy needs a lot of money for some reason, I got to have X amount of dollars. You know, I had one guy, he wanted to buy a tractor for his farm. I need $30,000 for a tractor. Okay, so I marked his timber three times because we had to mark a little more and a little more till we got to the $30,000 mark, you know. And we marked it a little harder than what I would have liked to. But it's a good looking, you know, you still look up on the mountain, it looks like a forest. Okay, yeah. So it's not ruined, right? But if you were to just take a logger and say, here, go cut my timber, he would have ended up with just a mess up there with stilt grass growing all over the place and busted up timber and nothing of value for the future.
Sure.
So what a forester, some of the things that a forester can do for you is, number one, the most important thing, I think, is marking the timber, tallying it up. I can give a landowner some vague idea of what it's going to sell for. A lot of times you're surprised at what it sells for, you know, both, you know, disappointed and pleasantly surprised. So once you have it marked and then I take the landowner in there and I say, here's how I'm marking it. What do you think? You know, envision how this is going to look without those marked trees there. They're going to be gone, right? And they could either say, geez, that's too hard, or yeah, keep going, or mark more. You know, I want to make the landowner happy. Because
yes.
If I mark it the way I want to do it, a lot of times the landowner will run me off because that's not what they wanted.
Yeah.
You know, I can give people advice on how it should be marked to meet his goals, or how it should be marked just in general. Like try to educate people on what is good for the forest, how to regenerate oak trees. It's not easy. What's going to happen after we do this harvest? And here's what you ought to do about that. You know, there's a lot of advice that I can give that you may or may not get from a logger. A logger, that's not his job. His job is to get the timber out, sell it. Hopefully you get your money. But I can tell you that I've had people call me, and it's very frustrating for me because it's like, why didn't you call me in the first place? You know, I had a guy call me during the winter last year, and he said, there's a guy cutting on my place, and he marked it, and I looked at it, and I said, yeah, that looks good. And then he's marking more. He's taking a lot more than what I had thought he was going to take. And I'm like, well, there's nothing I can do about it. I said, do you have a written contract? Yeah. I said, well, you can't do anything. You could tell him to leave, but you can't. I always tell people, you know, once you cut a tree, you have to be careful because once it's down, you can't put it back up. It's gone. Yeah. All right. So you have to be very careful about how you go about it. And the thing about a forester is that there's all different types of foresters too, you know?
Sure.
You know, I'm more wildlife oriented. and not so much just a money guy. So I'm always thinking about the wildlife and the habitat and the future of the forest, where some foresters, they're definitely out for as much money as possible, because a percentage of 100,000 is a lot better than a percentage of 70,000, right?
So, right.
But I usually just try to do what I would do if it was my property, and then go from there.
Right.
But also, when you're selling timber, here's the thing about selling timber is that it's such a slow process of growing these trees that if you, let's say you're a farmer, like your farmer friend, your client, you know, he's gonna own that farm for what, 50 years maybe? And in that 50 years, you might have one, maybe two harvests on your woodlot. So he doesn't have a lot of experience, right? So a guy like me, I'm selling timber all the time. I get on all different types of properties and different regions and run into different problems. I'm pretty experienced on how to go about the process, where your average landowner just doesn't, because he doesn't have any experience. It might be a once and done thing. You know, he sells his timber, it's the woods are trashed, and you know, I get calls from people that call me up and say, well, the logger said that the last time I cut it, though, I could cut it again in 10 years. Well, when a guy says that to me over the phone, I usually just say, well, most likely that's not the case. Okay.
Yeah.
So, that almost never happens. You know, it takes 10 years for a tree to grow about an inch in diameter. It's just so slow.
It's a very
now
slow
you can
process.
Speed that up with proper management. You know, you could double that growth, but that's where I come in too, is to figure out what kind of silvicultural prescription is needed for each and every stand. I'm working on a piece right now that's 861 acres. It's kind of fun to look at. I got all excited because I thought, boy, 800 acres, man, there's got to be some timber there, right? But it's already been totally destroyed.
Mm.
And there's nothing really left there to harvest except for ties and pallets, okay? There's no real high-quality timber left. But I did a management plan for them, and I ended up with 13 stands, all to be treated differently, depending on what was there. So that's what the map that I'm waiting for. We're going to turn that into NRCS, and then we'll go for EQIP funds, which right. is one of the things that I do, is try to help people get funding to do things that need to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And it usually has to do with regeneration of oaks.
There's a couple things I'm taking away from this, and I want to reiterate, because I can relate to you on a lot of cases, because you're a forestry consultant and I'm an agricultural consultant. And
right.
the biggest thing with a consultant, if you're a good consultant, jury's still out if I'm still a good consultant or not, but the thing I have learned is, if you're doing your job well, you've got knowledge, and you're going to take the complex portions of this topic at hand, and you're going to try to break it down into something simple and applicable. And it's also going to orient yourself to the goals in which the person you're working for is going. And I think, you know, you get with clients, and I get with clients, that they're really, really smart people. Like the things that they've done in their life, they're very successful. They understand a lot. They understand a lot, like enough to get themselves in trouble a lot of the times. And I...
All right, folks, it's that time of year for fall food plot planning. And this year, I'm proud to be working with Vitalize Seed. I work with them because they're great people and they're extremely passionate about wildlife and soil health. My fall food plots will be planted in Vitalize's Carbon Load, a 16-way diverse mix that is highly attractive to whitetails and has countless benefits to soil and soil health. If you've ever been overwhelmed by the hundreds of different seed blends on the market, check out Vitalize's 1-2 planting system. It's designed how nature intended, to make biology work for you. Now, each plant species in the blend has the proper ratio of seed to grow synergistically, not allowing any to outcompete another. This provides season-long forage for wildlife as well as benefiting the soil biome. There's no need for complex crop rotations with monocultures that are susceptible to drought and overbrowsing. Whether you plant with fancy no-till equipment or a bag spreader and a lawnmower, Vitalize can work in any food plot. For more information about Vitalize and soil health practices, visit VitalizeSeed.com and be sure to follow them on Instagram and Facebook.
Listen, landowners, let Stephen Chilcote, land and timber consultant, turn your land into a deer and wildlife magnet. With over 25 years of land and timber management experience, Steve's approach optimizes food and cover to attract deer and increase hunting success for his clients. Visit us online at chilcoteforester.com or call Steve today at 814-360-4510 to make sure your land is the ultimate hunting paradise.
To me, I embrace that because, number one, from my point of view, I get to learn so much from their perspective. But you provide a lot of value, Steve, in what you do as a forestry consultant, because you're gonna bring the little nuances, that gray area that somebody doesn't have the experience in, and you're gonna put that into perspective how one decision could alter your goals and objectives for the rest of your experience managing this forest stand. You know what I mean? Like your knowledge that you bring brings things full circle. And I think a lot of people look at working with a consultant as like demeaning or like less value. Like, I can't do this alone. I have to have somebody help me. And I look at that in anything in life as, first of all, it says multiple times in the book of Proverbs that there's wisdom within a multitude of counsel, from the angle that if you put wise people around you to help make decisions, you're going to make more wise decisions. And I believe that wholeheartedly in the topic we're talking about when it comes to forestry and forestry management. And I think
that's one of my favorite verses in the Bible, actually. That I haven't heard that for a while, but yeah.
And it applies to so much. And I just, when I think about what you're talking about, you have run into so many situations over the years. I've run into situations over the years of somebody has a picture in their mind of what they want to do, and there's either things that don't go the way they expected, or they didn't get the full picture. They miss something. And that's where, if you do it right the first time, you can avoid yourself with a lot of headaches. So, I think with going into that, talk to me a little bit about how you approach that, right? Because you said you're more wildlife oriented. There's so many questions I could ask right now, but I'm going to try to keep this simple for somebody who's possibly thinking about having their timber cut. What are the things you are asking a landowner when you're trying to make wise decisions for this to be successful?
Well, I've learned the hard way over the years to listen first. Okay. I've had people get really angry and run me off because I didn't cut enough trees. They wanted everything cut, all the money, every penny you could get, right? And I'm out there happily marking the timber and leaving these big old legacy trees. And it's like, why didn't you mark that big tree? It's like, well, why didn't you mark it down to 12 inches? Like, well, the difference between marking it 16 inches and 12 inches, that those trees, those smaller trees, are worth so little that it doesn't really add that much to your timber sale monetarily.
Well, stop that thought right there, because that's something I don't quite understand. And I think there's a lot of people listening that probably don't understand. Can you explain to me the value of a tree like you just started? Explain to me the value of the tree and the size of the tree, and give us a better picture of what that means for us in our timber harvest.
When I do a timber sale, I like to keep my diameters over 18 inches. And the reason for that, you know, it's a good educational thing for somebody to do, is go to a small sawmill that you can actually walk up and see them saw on the, you know, like an Amish mill. Or you get a tour of a mill. You know, you can ask for a tour. And watch them saw a log. And then you can start getting a picture of the material that's coming off that tree. So then when you're in the woods, you can look at a tree and say, yeah, you know, I saw them saw one of those big 24-inch oaks, and man, they've got some beautiful timber, you know, beautiful boards came off of that, and they got a lot of boards. You know, you could only, you take a 12-inch tree that has 40 feet of timber in it, and that 40 feet is not high quality because you can't get a big board, and you can't get a, you know, you're, once you take one board off of either side, and maybe a, maybe one more on the butt log itself, you're down to a cant. Well, the cant goes to the pallet mill. It's junk, right? It just doesn't sell for much of anything. It's worth 15 cents. Where if you have a big, like yesterday, I was with a guy, and I've been trying to get this guy to cut some timber for 15 years, but all he ever calls me about is killing his ailanthus and stiltgrass. So I'm down there looking at ailanthus trees, and I said, hey, pull over here. Got out the D-tape. This tree was 31 inches in diameter. It's a beautiful white oak. It had no defect till about 25 feet up. Now that tree might be, it might have 700, 800 board feet in it. Maybe more. And it's all high quality. And that tree could be worth a couple $1,000 if the butt log goes to veneer. As opposed to, so you could have 1,000 feet there, or you could have 20 of these little 14-inch oak trees that are full of defect, and they're real short because they haven't grown yet, and you cut them down just when it's starting to make money for you, right? So in other words, when you're growing an oak tree, it'll grow for 50 years until it gets to that 12-inch mark, and then the next 50 years is when it's making you the money. Even though you can count that 12-inch tree as saw timber, is it really saw timber? Like, I would never mark that to sell because it's going to go to a pallet log that's worth 15 cents rather than wait until it's worth 80 cents to $2 a foot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think I got off on a tangent there, but I...
Well, that's okay. I mean, it sounds to me it's the epitome of stepping over a dollar to pick up a quarter in some senses is kind of what it sounds like to me. And I'm just going to make a blanket statement. You tell me if you completely agree with this, partially agree with whatever you think, but from the hunting world and the people that are listening to this and myself included, I want to own land. I would love to save my money up and own land. And when I think about why I want to own land, it's for hunting purposes. And you want to own the best piece of land, the most land, to have the biggest room to do all the things I want to do. But I think there's an issue here. And I learned this from other people. I'm starting to apply this when I think about the time that I might purchase land is, if you buy the most, like the biggest, most expensive piece of land that you can afford, and you don't have a lot of leeway beyond that, meaning I don't have a lot of investment to invest into the land itself. Like, I want to put stands up. I want to do food plots. That's going to cost money. I'm gonna do it. So I think a lot of people get themselves in this situation where they've save themselves up, they can afford it, they can afford the taxes, but everything else they want to do, they don't have the resources for. So then, I want to cut this land because if I, you know, kill the overstory, I'm going to create wildlife habitat and I'm going to retain all this money that I can do to the land. But really, it might not work that way for everybody. So in the long term, you might shoot yourself in the foot. Is that something that, do I have my frame of mind right there, or is it wrong?
I think what you're talking about is that you want to use your timber sale to rotate that income back into the land to make your habitat better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I specialize in. And I was with a guy yesterday after the first millionaire, I went to see another millionaire. And going back to what you were saying before, where these guys, when you are working with wealthy landowners, these guys, I always try to feel them out on how they got wealthy and try to get some advice, you know, some life advice, you know.
Sure.
And I always find that they're the nicest guys, the really rich guys. And So this guy yesterday, he bought a drone. He bought a thermal drone just to look at his deer. Okay? That's how rich this guy is. So he goes, oh, it's 5 o'clock. I don't have to go for another hour. Let's fly the drone around. And was that ever cool? That thing could zoom in on a groundhog. You know, you could see that there was something there on the thermal, and then you just zoom in on, and there's this groundhog just as plain as day. It was the coolest thing I've ever seen. So anyway, he told me that normally they're not out yet and the acorns are coming down, so they're really not on the food plots that much. But he told me, he said, Steve, man, there's so many deer here now. I've been working on this property for about 3 years. He said, it's exactly like you told me. Every one of these food plots has a particular doe group that goes in there every night. Because I remember when I first told him, he called me up because he wanted a food plot. All right. So once I got there, I said, you really need to regenerate this timber, because deer need timber. They need regeneration, plants on the ground, stuff that they can reach to eat, not just food plots, right? So it took me a long time to convince them. I had to take them out in the woods, and I had to mark trees and say, you know, this is what, you know, these trees are going to be gone. These ones are going to stay. And he thought about it and thought about it. And then he said, okay, let's go. And I made, so far, I think we have 7 food plots now. I created a monster. Well, I put 5 in for him, and he's put in, no, I guess there's 8. He put 3 more in by himself, which are beautiful. You know, he's a really meticulous type guy. So he was in there with his dozers. He's a contractor, so he has equipment and he can do all sorts of things. So it's working out fantastic for him. We just by the grace of God, we found this unbelievable logger who is totally on board with what we're trying to accomplish, and he's doing a fantastic job. And we have this beautiful, I actually made a video yesterday out there. It's a short showing the canopy and how it's all spaced out now. And it's mostly cherry that was left, because the previous landowner took all the oak out, like almost 100% of it. And, you know, in 50 years, it's going to be a beautiful stand of cherry. And you never know, that the cherry prices might be great in 50 years. We don't know. But his grandkids can sell that maybe.
Sure.
But in the meantime, it's going to attract a ton of deer. And as it thickens up over the next 3 years, it's going to thicken up. Right now, the deer mostly bed down over on the state land where they did a lot of cutting before, and it's thick. Mm-hmm. When it thickens up here, it's going to be really good, because now we have all the food and the cover. Right now, it's just food.
Yeah.
So they aren't really bedding down that much there.
Well, you're starting to flirt with a question that I want to ask you, but I want to maybe step a touch laterally in order to get there. And we're talking about framework of goals, right? You know, how do you set your goals? What do you actually want the forest to look like? And I think that probably one way that would help private landowner type people listening to this, and also public land, when it comes to the types of cuts out there, and maybe having an understanding of the forestry side and what that looks like and what the goals are from the forestry end, might help frame a holistic goal of wildlife as well. So like the cutting that I'm used to when I think about it are like, you know, heavy clear cuts. I think about, you know, selective thinning and things like that. And then there's, you know, selective from the side of high grading versus, you know, selective in actually trying to enhance the good quality trees, thinning inside of just felling trees and letting the best stand to be maximized. There's shelter wood. I don't fully understand shelter wood cuts. I'm probably missing cuts. So walk me through some of the types of cuts, and let's just keep the frame of mind of just forestry. We want to produce timber. So what are these cuts doing for us for maximum profit, maximum timber value?
The term select cut is something that gets thrown out a lot. and it sounds great. We're just going to select a tree here and a tree there and let the little ones grow. And that's usually when somebody says select cut, like if a logger comes on your property, we're just going to select cut it. Yeah, and then the landowners are invariably, yeah, that's what I want. But a select cut, if you were to go to say, Austria, Germany, where they practice real forestry over there, when they select a tree, they're going to select one like the one I was telling you about earlier, that 31-inch tree. It's ready. Your bugs are starting to get into the bark, and, you know, you might look up and the crown is thinning a little bit. Well, let's select that to harvest and take it out. That's the proper select cut. What loggers usually mean when they say select cut is I'm going to high grade the place. I'm going to select whatever I want and leave the birch, the crooked red maple, all the junk, right? Anyhow, the next thing then are your, let's go to crop tree thinning. Okay, I might go in and tell you that, boy, that's just a beautiful stand of oak. But and the story you were telling about the farmer, the first guy that looked at it was probably thinking along these lines, where it's too small. Let's just wait for a little while. You know, give it another 10 years and you'll have twice the money, right? Then the next guy came in and he's, well, there's 14, 16-inch trees all over the place in here. I'm going to buy them off you. So what I would do in a crop tree thinning, I would pick the very best trees, and I would make sure that I crown release everything around that tree.
Define that crown release.
When another tree's crown is touching the crown of your crop tree, you want to remove that.
Gotcha.
One way or the other. Even if it's completely worthless and there's no pulpwood market around you, just kill it, you know. So then, like, let's say there's beech in there, right? Or if you're down in this region where red maple isn't really worth a lot, you want to take out your red maples and let the oaks grow. So that will double the rate of growth on a tree. And you can see it when you cut a tree down and look at the rings. You'll see that, they grow really fast, and then they become almost microscopic. Do you ever see that?
Mm-hmm.
When you look at a stump?
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, they widen out again because something happened. You know, it either the trees around it died or they got cut, and then it can get more sunlight and more water. So a tree is made out of air and water, with sunlight kickstarting giving it the energy to grow. Okay. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
So the more resources it has to grow, the faster and bigger it's going to get. So that's a crop tree you cut. And then when I want to regenerate timber, I could either use a clear cut. So if there's just no hope for the trees, you know, the trees are all junk, 100% junk, I might want to clear cut that. And then just let whatever is in the seed bank, let it take off, right? And then you could get stump sprouts and stuff coming up from seed. And in some cases, you don't get any trees, but that's a whole other story. But you might have to replant, you know. And so then we have... the next stage down would be your shelterwood cuts, which they call it shelterwood because you leave enough shade that the sun isn't really beating down on the ground, but there's enough light to grow new trees. So you have your shade-tolerant trees and you have shade-intolerant trees, and usually the intolerant trees are the high-value stuff, the oaks and cherries, sugar maple. Sugar maple will grow in the shade, but it doesn't. It just exists in the shade. So a sugar maple, I'm going way off into the weeds.
No, it's fine. This is good information.
A sugar maple 2 inches in diameter. I remember the one professor that was on my committee, he had a slideshow, and in his slideshow, he showed a picture of a sugar maple in the 60s, and then he showed it again in the 80s and again in the 90s. It was the same.
Okay.
It never grew. You know, it's there, but it didn't grow. So, but oak won't grow at all if it doesn't have a lot of sun.
Right.
It just won't take off. You might notice sometimes when you're out on state land and you're walking down a trail or a road, there's good oak saplings on the side of the road because a lot of sun is getting in. And then back in the woods, you don't see any because it's too shady. So you have your shade intolerance. You have to get enough light in there to grow oak and cherry and sugar maple. And that's where your money is.
And that makes a lot of sense when you explain that. Because, like, I go up to state forests and hunt state forests, and there's all these shelter wood cuts and stuff like that. And, like, right. Guys in camp, I don't understand why they cut it this way. And, like, I don't understand enough about forestry, but I know there's logic behind what you're talking about. One question I had for you as you were explaining those types of cuts, now we're going to throw into the mix wildlife, right? And guys have ideas of what they want to do for wildlife. Clear cutting... You talked about clear cutting from the stance of this forest doesn't really have a lot of hope, so we want to try to restore the seed bank and get trees established. When you throw wildlife into that, I think that gives people a different idea of what a clear cut is for. Does that muddy the waters at all in your line of work or from your experience between the like blending those two and what a clear cut is used for?
Well... I'm not sure what you're having that question.
So when you think about a clear cut, you talk about a clear cut, guys will say, all right, I want to clear cut this because I want to, you know, overwhelm with sunlight and provide forage for deer, right? But right. I think people will think they want to clear cut a section and it might actually be the completely wrong prescription for that mm-hmm. section of woods based on the type of timber that are there. So like there's places I'm sure that have gotten clear cut that they just did nothing but shoot themselves in the foot because the timber stand, you could have achieved your wildlife goal, but you actually ruined the forest stand long-term because you took
trees. Big property I'm working on right now up in the Mishannon. That's exactly what happened. It was high graded real bad. So the new owners decided that they would invite a logger in and do which is the next type of silviculture is the seed tree cut, where you really don't have very many trees left at all. It's just enough seed trees that seeds can fall down and germinate. Mm-hmm. Now with oaks, you have to leave more seed trees because it's a heavy seeded tree, right? The seeds don't travel far from the tree unless an animal carries them. Maples, on the other hand, have the winged seeds, and they can blow in the breeze. Aspen can blow for miles, right? So it all depends on what kind of trees you're trying to get. Now, in their case, they didn't have any regeneration on the ground yet. You never want to take away your overstory until your regeneration is in place. And that's what the shelter wood is for. The shelter wood allows plenty of seed trees. And then when you start seeing, you know, oaks don't seed every year, especially white oaks. It might be years and years until you get a good crop. So unless you start seeing oak seedlings on the ground, you don't want to take your seed trees away. Once you have that established, then you can do a two-stage shelter wood. You thin it, let it seed in, wait for regeneration to start, then you take the rest of your overstory off and let it take off. And in the meantime, you might want to use herbicides. You might want to use burning and stuff like that so that you can favor the oaks. Oak silviculture, and that's really what my training is. But it's a very, very difficult thing. It's harder than I ever even imagined it would be, especially today with invasives.
Absolutely.
Now, let me say one more thing about clear cuts is that with the deer pressure that we get in the woods, you don't want to do anything less than about 100 acres. Wow. So if you're going to clear cut, you better clear cut a big area because, you know, I've had this happen where I thought I was doing it right. You know, I did a seed tree harvest, left a bunch of oaks. The oaks died, so they, you know, most of them died, so I don't have much seed. I sprayed the ferns, but the ferns came back because the deer got in there and they ate all the trees as they started coming up. But it was too small, right?
You got to overwhelm the deer in that case.
You really have to. You have to overwhelm them, exactly, so that trees can get out ahead of them. Now, if you have a clear cut and it comes up with blackberries and saplings and all different species, and then you have forbs in there, well, that's deer habitat right there. At least for probably 10 years, you'll have deer just coming in there like crazy. They're going to use it for cover. They're going to use it for food and escape cover. So during hunting season, they're going to want to crawl in there because they know that they can hide, you know. So clear cuts are excellent for deer habitat.
Right.
But they're more practical on state land where you have 3,000 acres in a stand, and then you can cut 100 acres, 200 acres, and it's okay.
Well, here's what I'm trying to learn myself. So, like, what you're describing right there, in my mind, is short-term thinking. Because a landowner, as a deer hunter, now I want to kind of bring this back to why somebody would be interested in having this conversation, because they want to do something on their property, right? They didn't have a good hunting season, or something's not working right, and they want to figure out what to do. And I think a lot of people think exactly what you just described. I'm going to cut trees. I want to create this early succession habitat, right? Everything under 5 feet, and it doesn't matter how I get there. That's just what I want. And that's short-term thinking. That's thinking, okay, I'm going to cut this down, and within the next 2 to 5, 10 years, I'm going to have that. Then what? You can do things that can maintain that 1 to 10 year stand, whether it's burning or continue to cut back and herbicides and stuff like that. What the question I want to ask you now is, with short-term thinking like that, what ramifications are we creating in the world of forestry management that are going to create a problem for generations to come?
I think that what you're driving at there is, like, when people do a treatment, say you do a clear cut or a patch clear cut or a strip, you know, there's different ways you can do clear cuts too. You can do strip clear cuts, which can be very productive, actually, as far as creating wildlife habitat.
Yes.
And what people don't realize is that that's not the end of it. You have to go back into your stand and constantly make improvements. So, you know, that first guy I was with yesterday, he did some thinning of some old field. He had some old pasture that grew up, and old pasture fields that go back to trees, that the trees aren't very high quality. They're usually pretty bad. So he had a logger come in and he thinned it all down, tried to keep the best ones. And then, of course, he has a lot of stuff in the understory coming along. So I said, you know, the problem is we're both like 69 years old. So there's only so much. He's going for knee surgery next week or something. Now, what you can do is go in there and find your oak trees or your cherries or whatever it is you want. And you can thin around those, starting right from seedling. You take one of those brush mowers, you know, and just go around your oak trees. They do this on federal land up north in the Allegheny. They'll have guys come in. I bid on some of that work, but I can't compete with the immigrant labor. And you go in there and you're up to your eyeballs in sticker bushes, right? You're getting scratched to hell. And you're supposed to find the cherry trees and trim everything around that cherry tree as far as what the cherry tree is high. So if it's 5 feet tall, you got to clear 5 feet around it. And that way, those cherries will outcompete and they'll take off and grow. But you have to, you know, another place comes to mind that where I was able to get funding for a fence. So I put a fence around this place. and it took off. And there were lots of oaks and different native plants. It was great. It looked fantastic for a while. But the cotton picking birch came in and shaded everything out. There wasn't a birch anywhere around there when I cut it, but the birch seed was in the ground.
Right.
From who knows, you know, I don't know how long it lasted. Some of these tree seeds, they can last up to 100 years.
Wow.
So they're in the ground and you don't know what's going to come up. So unfortunately, you know, I kept saying to the landowner, hey, we should go in and take care of this birch, right? And then I tried to go to the NRCS and ask them for EQIP funds to help with it, and they didn't want to fund that. And so finally, it was like too little too late. We went in there, me and some guys that hunt there just went in with chainsaws and started cutting birch trees down. But they weren't very good at cutting birch trees, and we didn't get very much. I got a lot down, but I was like, what did you guys even do all day up here? You know, I'm looking around. There's still a lot of birch.
It's a whole other topic of conversation when it comes to how much you can actually cut.
Well, and then, you know, all the oaks, unfortunately, got shaded out, and they end up dying. They can't get enough sunlight.
Makes sense. Well, I got two. Go ahead.
The bottom line is you have to constantly nurture what you have. It's just, you know what? Think of a forest like a garden. You don't plant your garden. Now, I do. I do it this way, but this is the wrong way to do it. Plant your garden. It looks fantastic. And then you get busy over the summer. You come back and like right now I can't even see if I have vegetables. The grass is up to my eyeballs down there.
Maintenance.
But I should have been weeding that all summer, and I didn't do it.
Right.
So now I got weeds, not vegetables.
And I got two other concepts. As always, like we could have a conversation about this the last 4 hours, and I don't know if we'd get the drive the points home for this. I mean, it's so much good stuff here. And there's two concepts I'd like to talk about here, and we're already 45 minutes in, so I want to be mindful of listeners and your time as well. But the thing I want to drive home, and the question I'm going to ask you relates to this, right? So I heard a couple people say this, and not just like buddies in conversation. I've heard this in media, and it's obviously important media that gives the idea to listeners like are listening to this podcast. And I personally think it's bad information, but I want to hear your take on it. And it revolves around incorporating wildlife into the mix for hunting. I heard people say that in your lifetime, you're going to get one good cutting for wildlife because they want to do what we're talking about, right? They want to cut the overstory and they want early succession and they want the junk and this and that and everything else. So when you hear that, Steve, you already established in the beginning of this podcast, you're a wildlife oriented forester. That's what you like. And I've talked with you enough to know like your priority is hunting and wildlife, but you're a forester. Mm-hmm. So when you hear something like that, which sounds appealing to somebody like me, who's a landowner and like, I want to shoot deer. I want to have wildlife. That sounds like that guy knows what he's talking about. I want your response and your thoughts to that as a wildlife oriented forester.
I want to say that silviculture is, and if you look up the definition, it's going to say something like it's the art and science of growing trees. So it's an art to begin with. So Jim Finley used to say in his talks that the forester with his paint can is an artist, and you're out there, you've got a palette to work with, and how you mark that stand is going to dictate how it goes forward in the future, of course. So the once in a lifetime thing, yeah. The guy I was talking to last night, I would say that he probably won't cut timber in his lifetime anymore. He's in his mid-40s. But what he can do is go in there and constantly make adjustments. I've already been in there spraying ferns, spraying the stilt grass, spraying some of the sassafras that's coming up, because that stuff will take over, right? Making adjustments, right? And you can, it all depends on what kind of harvest you did. That's a total regeneration harvest. So we're starting all over again with 10, 11-inch diameter cherry trees and a few oaks here and there. That's all we have to work with for seed. Now, some of the ongoing things that we're going to do, like in the wintertime now, I'm going to, you know, your buddy that you turned me on to is going to come and fly a drone over there and spread conifer seeds. Because I'm thinking there's enough bare soil showing here. I bet I could direct seed this thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to wait till it snows. And then we're going to get some seeds and put them on. Now, that's an expensive thing.
Yeah.
But that's what I like about wealthy people, you know, that take advice. If I say, hey, man, I think we ought to try this. It costs $4,000. Yeah, let's do it. You know, I love those guys because I can try things that you know, I may never have tried before. And we can experiment and try to make things better. So he's got some pine trees on there that are they look to be a loblolly pine, I think.
Okay.
They're just beautiful. And I'm thinking, you know, the soil likes these pine trees. Let's get some pine trees going. Let's work with what the site likes. You know, you have all different soils, as you know. Different soils are good for different types of trees. So, you know, you might have a dry site and you want to favor chestnut oak. And then you have a more moist site and you want to favor the red oak. And then you have something in between and you have real well-drained northeast slopes. That's where the sugar maple wants to be. There's a lot of nuance to this.
There's a lot of nuance to it. And it reiterates the point we talked about at the beginning about taking the complex and breaking it down simple. And I personally, I've said this before, I'll say it again. I believe in the world of forestry and the world of deer hunting and wildlife, I believe you can have your cake and eat it too. Like you can get a good, absolutely. You might not be able to get the best of both worlds, but you can get really, really good in both worlds.
When you think about it, going back to oak silviculture, you know, the number one food that gets deer through the winter, which is the impoverished period of time in a deer's life. If there's no acorns, they have nothing to eat.
Yes.
In the winter generally. And even if they eat them all, even if they're gone by March, they've put enough fat on that the deer can live off of that fat. So if we're doing a shelter wood and leaving all high quality oak trees that are known acorn producers, then you're going to have lots of acorns and you're going to feed more deer than you could ever feed in a food plot. We have one like that in the Poconos right now that the landowner is just, he's up to his neck in big bucks. It just has worked out so fantastic for him. And luckily we had enough white oak. The last time they high graded it, white oak wasn't real pricey. So they left a lot of it. And that's what we used for our seed trees. And they're making tons of seed and it's working out really good. So the two do go together very well, because if I do a shelter wood and start getting a thicket coming up and we get lots of blackberry and forbs and vines and everything, weeds and whatnot that deer can eat, and they have that food and cover, and then in the fall they have the nuts that are coming down out of those oak trees, you really have the best of both worlds. You don't even need a food plot at that rate. Mm-hmm. Although I always recommend food plots, because there's just so much forage there and it gets them from early spring all the way through till fall, till when they switch over to acorns and browse.
Right.
But you need both. If you're doing a wildlife habitat type of harvest, what we usually try to do is get regeneration save the good oak trees for acorns because we don't have the chestnuts anymore. We don't have beech anymore. You know, those things are all going by the wayside. And those were really high quality foods that are gone. And now, unfortunately, we're having a lot of trouble with oak because, you know, you have gypsy moth, sudden oak death, and armillaria root rot. There's so many things attacking oaks right now. It's really kind of making people nervous because they say it's climate change, you know, like things are warmer and things are changing in the woods. And we have invasives that we never had before. They're getting worse and worse. Mm-hmm. So you have to be extremely careful. You don't just, you know, I keep going back to calling up loggers and say, hey, just, I'm ready to cut my timber. Well, are you? You know, if you really, really need the money, if you have cancer and you need a surgery and you got to have the money, then you got to have the money. But I wouldn't sell timber that way. I would get some advice. And if you don't like the advice that one forester gives you, interview three of them. See which one kind of clicks with and seems like you're on the same page.
I like that, Steve. And I think the last thing we should talk about before we wrap this one up is just give us a picture of like what's forestry markets like and how should we as somebody who might be wanting to cut timber just from the perspective of what might be going on state land we hunt, like how does that frame our decision making moving forward to the next year, 2 years as we go into hunting seasons and stuff?
Timber markets, pretty crazy. And I can tell you that maybe people don't realize this, but most of the hardwood timber that we cut in Pennsylvania is shipped out overseas, the really high quality stuff. That's the big dollar stuff. It goes to China, it goes to Vietnam, Indonesia, and people are using it over there. Sometimes they're making things over there and then sending it back here, like flooring and things. But as markets are changing constantly, so if you have a tariff war with China or styles change, like if you go into new housing today, you don't see red oak cabinetry anymore. People, that's out of style. And you don't see red oak hardwood floors anymore. So you can still get them, but it's not in vogue right now. China, it was kind of interesting. I was talking to a guy that he's at DCNR and he studies markets, foreign markets. And he said what happened was with China, they were building these high rises and they would build out these condos with no finish. And then people finished them the way they wanted. And it was really stylish to have American hardwood in there. Well, now they finish them ahead of time. So what's the cheapest way anymore? Is the plastic flooring, just paint the walls, you know, drywall and paint, no trim. And then the cabinets are usually like composite, right? That's the cheapest thing you can do. So that's what changed the markets there in China. And then the tariff thing is making a mess of things. So prices have been really, really volatile. But I can tell you that white oak, the stave market has always been good because in foreign countries now, it's real stylish to drink American whiskey. And I only learned this like 5 years ago. I didn't realize that you have to, when you make a barrel of whiskey, you have to get rid of that barrel. You got to put a fresh barrel, right?
Okay.
So there's a large demand for the staves to make these barrels. So that's why white oak, that's shoring up the white oak prices right now. So red oak is down. It used to be the other way around. Red oak was king. White oak was there, you know. It's not the greatest. And then cherry was through the roof for a while. And then for a while, like you couldn't move it at all. Hmm. Nobody wanted it. And then with some mill closings, you know, things went pretty bad there for a while. With mill closings, a lot of times the mills that are left, they get full. from loggers bringing logs in. They're full. They don't want it. So then they're going to offer a low price. They figure, hey, if I can get it for this price, I'll take it. But I'm not going to offer big money for it because I'm full, you know. And then and that depends on the orders that they're getting for their final product, right? So there's a lot of factors at play that drive that market. And that's why I often tell people, I think sometimes people get the idea that timber prices are kind of like commodity prices, where you can open up the Wall Street Journal and see what gold is going for today, mm-hmm. right? Or pork bellies, right? It's not like that. It depends on the quality, how far it is to the mill, what those mills' orders are, how full they are. If you have a guy who has a sawmill and he's all out of logs and he doesn't want to lay off his workers, he's going to pay, he might take a bath on that timber. He might offer twice what the next guy offered because he has to keep his mill open, you know. So that's part of my job, is to find out who wants it the worst.
Sure. And what right. I think the biggest thing there that I'm gathering, Steve, is not only like the stuff we talked about in this podcast, how, you know, waiting a little bit from a 16-inch tree to an 18-inch tree, like how that can make you more money, but the value of having somebody with the knowledge you just shared right there. You know, you take a walk on somebody's property and say, hey, between the markets and what you have here, waiting is not only going to help grow the trees that you have, waiting with the type of timber that you have could also make you a ton more money if you just waited a little bit longer. And that's information you don't get when you have somebody come onto your property and say, ah, we can cut a bunch of trees here and get you cash now.
Yeah.
Big difference there.
Yeah, what I was hoping for when I got into consulting was that a lot of people would hire me long term and I could spend my whole career just managing people's properties. But I find that most people don't think that way.
Sure.
Usually when they call a forester or a logger, they just decide they want some money or it's time. You know, I cut 15 years ago. It's time to cut it again. We should cut some timber. They think it grows like corn, and it doesn't. It takes management. It really is an art.
Yeah.
And it's getting more and more difficult because of invasives.
I think that's a good place to put a pin in this, and we can revisit more aspects of this because maybe we scratched the surface on a couple great topics. I think it's just going to give a lot of fuel for thought as people going into hunting season. Probably is going to help them understand cuts on public land they hunt a little bit better, and it's probably going to help you gain perspective as you're sitting in your deer stand and you're thinking, man, I would really like to improve this aspect of my property. I think a cut is there. This is going to give them the fuel to say, well, maybe I need to wait, or maybe I need to call somebody like Steve.
Yeah, I'm the best in the world, but, you know, if you don't call me, you know, you can look in the DCNR has a list of consulting foresters, and I've never joined the ACF. ACF is a group of foresters that are all consultants, and they have a website, and they have a section called Find a Forester, and you can look there. I try to stay active on social media so that there's awareness out there that I'm there. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of people, they don't even, it's a shame that people don't really understand the value of a forester. They just don't get it.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I hear it all the time. Why should I pay you 10% when the guy from the mill will come and market? Well, that's like asking what a used car salesman what your car's worth, right? He wants to steal it off you.
100%.
So, you know, you want somebody in your corner. I often use the analogy, like when you go to court, you want a lawyer because that lawyer knows the judge. They probably golf together. They know the ropes, right? They know what's going to happen before it even happens, right? So you'd be stupid to go without a lawyer. wouldn't you? Like, nobody would even do that. Nobody would even think that. But they'll go into a timber sale day in and day out with people are selling timber without a forester with no advice.
That's a great analogy.
I guarantee you, it turns into a mess, especially when a landowner decides that he's going to have several people come in and give him a price. It's just the worst thing because nobody ends up winning. Nobody ends up happy because you got a guy that only wants certain trees. You got a guy who he'll cut everything. And then you got a guy who cares about the woods and he's not going to offer you money on every tree in there. And then you get the landowner. Sometimes you'll give a guy a price, a really solid price. This just happened last fall. That's why I'm thinking about it. You know, this logger asked me to help him mark a piece. We marked it. I tallied it all up, and he gave him the best price he could possibly give him. And we know damn well that he took that price and went to this local sawmill over here and told him what the price was. He and I marked it. So we carefully tallied each and every tree. That guy just took our price and said, well, I'll give you $5,000 more than that. He never had to mark it. Is that fair? Not really.
Yeah, fair's a place where hogs wear blue ribbons, right? Well, Steve, I appreciate you coming on. This is a wealth of information here, and I think we could probably have a lot to revisit here in the future with it. Anything you want to leave us with before we go?
Man, there's a lot more that we could discuss. What we should do is probably discuss on another podcast maybe the invasive problem would be a good subject, and then incorporating, you know, we could talk more about incorporating timber sales into your wildlife habitat stuff.
I like that. I'm writing that down, and we're going to put a pin in that for at some point in the near future. Steve, I, as always, appreciate your knowledge on this show and coming on. And
We should talk about the other thing. We should talk about are these forest management plans. I just did a video on forest management plans. It only got 62 views, but I said in there if you fail to plan, you plan to fail.
Makes sense.
It doesn't hurt to pay a if you spend $1 million on a piece of ground to hunt on. What's a few $100 to have a forester come out and take a look at it?
Right.
You could get a cruise, get a plan written. You know, I charged for that 861 acres. It was like I charged them $4,000, which wasn't enough money, but they're going to get a really nice plan, and they know they have a recipe for every stand in there, all 13 stands, what they should do over the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. Pretty nice to have. Plus, you know, we can talk about this further, but I've gotten people an awful lot of money from the NRCS to do work on their properties that needed to be done that's just unaffordable without the aid. So, you know, there's a chance of getting some really nice funding and getting some work done on your property. So that would be a good subject for a podcast.
I think that's a great subject for a podcast. But until then, good luck hunting, because I know you'll probably get out here soon.
Yeah, a couple of weeks.
That's for sure. Well, thanks again, Steve.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.